Big Red Bench. Game on. Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m.
The Joanna Reardon Podcast. A Big Red Bench production for Cork's Red FM.
Hello and welcome back to the Joanna Reardon Podcast with me, Joanna Reardon, on Cork's Red FM. In episode 8, we continue our discussion with Dr. Katie Liston, who is a senior professor in University of Ulster Jordanstown, and we continue our discussion about concussion in sport today.
You know, I mean, obviously there's different variations of concussion, and I think obviously everyone can see, like I remember when Jan Vertonghen, the Spurs player, when he got concussed, you could physically see it. You know, we all saw it unfold in front of us, that he was like, he looked a bit sick, he was groggy, he couldn't stand on his own. And I remember then I was reading articles then about like how, you know, they were talking about hitting the ball and how like it's the tiny little vibrations that could end up being more dangerous. I can't remember what article it was. And then I remember Roy Keane came out and saying, oh, well, the scientists can say that, you know. And I remember just immediately there was like this dismissal, like, OK, everyone can see if anyone gets punched in the head, they're concussed. But something as like definitive as hitting the ball, which you have to do in sports, yeah, that immediately caused like that's total lies. Do you find that happens in a lot of sports? Like if it's something like a tackle in rugby? You know.
Yeah, I do, Joanne. Not just in rugby. And in some ways, rugby's taken the brunt of this because I suppose the awareness around it has been more obvious because it's a high contact, even what we might call now a collision sport today. Mm. But it's not on its own, because even some so-called designated non-contact sports, you can still experience brain shaking because you may fall. You may have a sudden impact with an opponent that was accidental. And it's just that process of the way in which the brain can shake inside the skull, which is one of the hardest bones in the body, that causes the potential tension to the nerves and may, as we say, exhibit into damage. But I try to explain to a lot of my students when we think about this injury that we should give it more thought. And we should also think about the ways in which it's going to provide a challenge for all of us, because essentially what we're saying, based on our awareness of concussion in particular, is that it's not the case that sport is simply good for health anymore. Mm. And this is the one injury that drives a wedge right up the middle of that argument. And we have to be willing to say sport may be good for health in some expressions and in some forms, but we have to acknowledge that the higher up the chain of performance we go, the more likely it is, in fact, that athletes' bodies will tend to break down because of the demands being made on them. And that's what worries me the most about this particular injury, because most of us at the weekends now, we're going out, we're the merry bands of young men and young women. Some of us arguably older, still trying to do it today. But we're taking part at an amateur level. And that's where the level of medical surveillance is at its lowest. So in children's sports and in what we'll call grassroots sports, there's far less medical intervention. I would say that we have a long way to go in terms of ensuring consistency in awareness about the injury. And it's in fact, probably most of the sports of the population involved in sports are in that category. And that's where more of the risk occurs, because the awareness is lower. There's less medical intervention. And we are more inclined to go, well, it's just a bang to the head. Up you get and you'll be all right. And in fact, of course, you don't need a bang to the head to experience this injury, because all you need is a high velocity shaking that can occur. So in many cases, we don't recognize it. And therefore, we have to be, I think, very cautious. Now, you mentioned earlier about the social view of concussion. And this, for me, is what's most critical, because I think most of the research and most of the funding at the moment is going towards the medical intervention into the injury. And of course, that's important. Don't get me wrong. But equally important is understanding the culture of risk that underpins the way in which most of us approach this injury and most other injuries, let's face it. But this one obviously has much higher risk. And I think our greatest social challenge, and it's going to take some time, is moving away from the culture of risk that is endemic in most sports, and towards more of a culture of precaution that is going to involve and will require, I suppose I can call it, more sensible risk taking. Now, most people might say, well, that's just common sense. I mean, you know, obviously we have to take less risks. But the message around concussion is certainly more than just common sense. And it's more than just getting the message across, because let's face it, if it were that simple, we would have it solved by now. Mm. And our awareness is only growing. There's another, I suppose, assumption that, well, if we hear from the experts, like you just mentioned it there, even though Roy Keane is dismissing some scientists, you know, expert knowledge and information will drive behavior. Let me give you an analogy. If we tell people that smoking is bad for them, they'll stop smoking. But guess what? They didn't.
Yeah.
Because we don't always think and act rationally in response to expert knowledge. So this is why the challenge around concussion is a much greater one, because it's deeply embedded in a whole set of attitudes and values in which it's expected that we will play and train through pain and injury, that in fact we will do so and we'll be rewarded for doing so because it's part and parcel of the game, whatever that might be. So we will deny pain, we will neutralize it in many cases, we will rationalize the benefits of taking part and maybe playing through particular injuries, and therefore we're almost protected. We have this ideological shield against the growing medical research and awareness that we have around it. And that's critical, because until we fully understand all of the attitudes around this injury in particular, we won't be able to crack the education initiatives that we would all agree, I think, are much needed around the injury.
Yeah, because I was just going to say there, like, when, you know, I was reading like some of your papers, and I was actually, I wasn't laughing because I know it's a serious issue, but one of the response to sports collision injury collectors' recommendation, you know, just about, you know, sport and things like that. And one of them responded, "We feel that those who are passionate about the game, its values and benefits will be the best place to respond, more so than those from the ivory tower." So it's almost like this weird disconnect has occurred from people who are concerned about head injuries to the people actually playing it. And I'm just kind of wondering, like, your thoughts socially, where do you think that comes from? Do you think it's a masculinity thing? Do you think it's like a general thing of people who enter sports that all of a sudden they're in like a cocoon, kind of sheltered away from everyone? Like, where does that kind of defensiveness, but more so the sheer desire to ensure that the sport is protected, no matter what the research says at all costs?
Yeah. I mean, there's a number of components to that. The specific quote that you have, Joanne, I obtained that privately from a colleague of mine working in the UK who had the inside track on how some of the national governing bodies in England in particular were responding to the call by the Injury Collective to potentially consider a ban on contact in underage rugby.
Yeah.
So the specific comment about the ivory tower did relate to the fact that so-called academics are in an ivory tower. They don't live in the real world, so it's very easy for them to come out and say we must ban contact in sport. But yet when you look at those who signed the letter in this injury collective, there were a whole raft of academic researchers, medical and social alike. So that's where this specific ivory tower comment came from. But more widely, you're right to point out that because we invest so much of ourselves, I said individually and collectively, in sport, there's a number of different stakeholders or invested groups in sport that probably are resisting change for a whole range of reasons. I mean, there are powerful interest groups, and this, by the way, was seen, for instance, in the response to smoking many years ago as well, powerful interest groups who actively try to undermine academic research. So deny the existence of concussion or downplay the supposed, as they would say, the supposed links with maybe long-term cognitive impairment. We know as well the way in which sport has changed, maybe particularly over the last 30 years or so in Ireland. There are now powerful commercial and market forces that are very difficult to change as individual national governing bodies, or as, you know, your ordinary, you and I, Joe Soap, a small club in rural Ireland somewhere. You know, we're not going to change the market forces that drive commercial sport. So there's two powerful groups in and of themselves. Then sometimes you will get resistance also from national governing bodies, international included. So that paper that you cited there, the one where we interviewed some amateur rugby players, we also quoted the chief executive of World Rugby, who was also forced to apologise on behalf of World Rugby for the organisation's response to that group of academics, because they misquoted and misled some of the readers about their representations of sports injury data. So sometimes there's a downplaying of the very real risks of pain and injury in particular.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think we downplay the whole thing? Like, why do you think, like, is it just because we fully believe that everyone in sport, I'm not saying is the perfect athlete, but that they can't get hurt? Is it like an idealistic view that we hold of athletes in particular?
Yeah, it is, I think. I mean, this is I would call it a quite a rose-tinted perspective. it emerged hand in hand with modern forms of competitive sport in the early 1900s, Joanne. I mean, if we look back to what we would call games and leisures and pastimes, roughly before the 1900s, they had a different form. But as the competitive ethos has heightened throughout the 20th century, you know, you think about the growth in the Olympic movement, for instance, what was called a Cold War became a sports war between some of the global sporting nations. So a gap has emerged between high performance and professional sports and grassroots sports. But the high performance sport is always the form and the level to emulate. So that's held up on the pedestal. So you will see very similar cultural values in grassroots sports that you see in high performance sports, but obviously, you know, differences in the levels of performance. So that's why I said earlier to you that it's very important that we kind of dig beneath the skin,
yeah,
the culture that's in sport, because what concerned me when we did our interviews with these amateur rugby players, and we've also conducted others, by the way, I probably should have said that to you, we just haven't published them yet, with county teams in football and hurling, including women's teams, rightly so. What it's showing us is that these cultural values around accepting pain and injury are very deeply embedded in the culture of sport generally, whether it's amateur or professional or high performance. And I mean, to give you just one example, and this was an interview maybe conducted last year with the youngest member of one county team, who said that, look, I know scientifically and logically that it's not good to play through pain and through injury. You know, you should be looking after your body and your health. You shouldn't be risking anything that's going to be a threat for you in the future. But here's what they went on to say, and I'm going to quote directly. But as a player, it's good playing through pain and injury. It makes you a stronger player and better in the future. And here's the most important one for me. It sounds so petty, but what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Now, I'm working alongside Peter Robinson, who you might know is Ben Robinson's father. Ben was a school's rugby player here quite close to me in Carrickfergus, and he died from second impact syndrome. He was just playing a school's rugby game. And to try and understand the rationalization of that athlete who sees this as part and parcel of the game, and I will do what I can for my team no matter what, doesn't sit well alongside the reality in which athletes can die if this injury is not taken seriously. And in fact, what does happen is that very instinct that can drive an athlete, that sporting instinct, could be the very thing that might kill them when we think about the context of brain shaking in particular. So I'm always passionate about trying to make the case for funding and investing in cultural, or you might call it social, research around sport as equally as we do medical research, because all of the education in the world, all of the expert knowledge in the world around the symptoms associated with concussion, the biomarkers, the blood saliva measures, all of that that's starting to come out now, it's important, but it won't have a meaningful change until we get to grips with the very attitudes that are driving a resistance to acknowledging this injury and its potential seriousness.
Do you think, just even going back to the medical thing, that we're like, when I'm watching a game, and if like VAR, for instance, happens, I'm getting angry because I'm wasting 5-6 minutes not watching anything. And therefore, I think the same thing happens when a player goes down with a head injury. We can't physically see that he's injured or she's injured, but we are getting more annoyed because a bit more attention is being paid to them and the game is stopped up. Do you think that's another issue as well that we have to deal with as fans? Like, we can't just sit there and demand that the player either goes off or, you know, is assessed properly on the field. Like, we want the game to kickstart again.
Yeah, we do. And I mean, in most injuries, whether it's a blood injury or a blow to the head, and you saw it in a number of cases in the recent Women's World Cup, of course, the referee has the right to stop the game and to call on medical treatment immediately. I certainly would be in favour of ensuring that we maintain precaution around concussion and any head injury in particular. But again, just to be clear, we can experience concussion without any blow to the head. Yeah. So sometimes it can look rather bizarre because you might see, and it's usually in the high performance professional levels, where you will see players potentially going off and being tested either pitch side or going through a number of other tests with doctors, having not had any kind of blow to the head, as it were. But we have to remember here, our brains are almost like a jelly-like feature that sit inside one of the hardest bones in our body. So a shoulder falling to the ground without necessarily a blow to the head or anything that can cause this shaking, we should be cautious about that, because the symptoms can take a while to reveal themselves. And also, I think one of the concerning things from players' perspectives is that because their adrenaline is rushing through so much, and the same for us as spectators, we're in the middle of it, we're supporting our team, we've invested in ourselves, we're not always going to be willing or able to say, hold on a minute, I don't feel right, or I need to take a time out here, where we might encourage somebody to self-report and say, can I just be checked out here, or I'm not sure if it's appropriate for me to stay on the pitch at the moment. That's one of the important messages that has been somewhat successful in high performance sport, in the context of encouraging players to recognize that they might actually be holding back their teams, yes, if they're playing with diminished cognition, as opposed to the adrenaline that drives them to say, no matter what, I'm going to stay on the pitch here. It's the last couple of minutes, you know, where I don't want to be, you know, reducing my team by, you know, a player less or whatever. So different messages will be required for different groups of people. But in a more holistic and a joined up way, Joanne, than certainly any of us have ever got to at this stage of concussion education. And I think we're very early in the process, to be honest. I mean, I remember my PhD supervisor saying to me consistently, because I got so frustrated at times when I saw the inequalities around women in sport, and he said, Katie, take a breath. You will recognize change. You will see it, and then you will be able to understand it and build on it. And he was absolutely right.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, here I am 15, 20 years later. I can think back to the players that I interviewed, the participation rates in those three sports, which were much lower than what they are now. We've had Six Nations championships. We've had, you know, Hockey World Cups. We've had successes that would have been unparalleled maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And cultural change takes time. I mean, some people argue it takes a generation fully before we'll see the benefits of it. So then, you know, how do you define a generation? I guess in sporting terms, a generation would be the average length of a playing career, which is probably around 10 to 15 years when you do consider that most of us will have some kinds of injuries that will eventually catch up with us over time. So concussion education and change around this injury is going to take some time. Many of us don't have time because it's such a serious injury. So
I was going to ask
I'm involved in, we're still trying to do more and understand more about the attitudes that are held by players around concussion, and then pilot a kind of an intervention education program that hasn't been done yet, to see if it's more effective. So come back to me in a year's time and I'll be able to tell you how successful or not we've been.
I was going to ask you about even like socioeconomic kind of places. Like, do you find that, you know, I suppose that the further you go down the food chain, as you were saying, to amateurs, to maybe clubs that are in a particular, like, you know, I don't want to say bad part of the road, but you know what I'm trying to say. Do you think that even they're more, even I would find now, like if you were thinking back to early GAA days with Cork GAA, I remember like certain players coming out now recently saying, you know, oh, I remember I got a bang to a head, and I remember I scored 1-3, and I don't remember the whole thing. And you hear, like, you know, kind of, I'm not saying like the elderly gentleman, but you hear like the likes of my dad or, you know, my uncles or things like that going, yeah, sure, he's a great man. You know, do you think that's another like issue as well? Like, do you think that's like passed down? You know, obviously I don't think it, you know, I think that's, you know, terrible to the highest level, but you have some people who would fully believe that's great just because, you know, it's the perfect sign of like masculinity, you know, and even in socioeconomic areas, you have to be more masculine, you know what I mean?
Yes. And I mean, sport was and arguably is a male preserve. I mean, that was one of the things that came out strongly in my own research to start with. But interestingly, in order to succeed in sport, you have to mirror those values. Mm-hmm. So they're no longer masculine in the sense of understanding that female players, individual athletes and team players alike will also mirror these same attitudes towards pain and injury. In fact, in some cases, it's argued, in some cases, and I don't always agree with it, that women have a higher tolerance to certain kinds of levels of pain and injury. And in other scenarios, they will express themselves around pain and injury slightly differently. So there is a gender dimension to it, undoubtedly. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the socioeconomic dimensions, and I suppose the inequalities, maybe the smaller clubs around the country that may be listening to us today that don't have the same resources, that are going, well, what can I do at a local level? We're just a small club. I mean, I come from a little village of 80 people, very small club. But in fact, those kinds of clubs could make much more of an inroad than some of the larger clubs in the more populated and dense areas around the country, precisely because of the leadership effect that we could have for coaches, senior members of a club, and those who in their own daily lives can mirror this culture of precaution. And even though sometimes it might be difficult, because of course winning brings a sense of pride, boosts the sense of belonging for the small clubs in rural Ireland, where I come from as well, but not at the expense of somebody's health. And I think local communities can play a very important role in that. And certainly local coaches, therefore, are likely to have a much greater input because of the way in which relationships are closer, networks are tighter. I've been at home recently as well, you know, chatting to local players, getting involved. My own nephew today has taken part in the underage high jump nationally as well. And the extent to which we're able to have that closeness and have the kinds of conversations maybe that wouldn't happen as much in high performance professional sport, where the onus and the responsibility is generally put onto medics, which isn't right also.
Yeah.
Because we all have to take a responsibility as players, as spectators, as parents or as guardians, as sponsors. And I think sponsors are going to be critical moving forward as well, because I think they will be less inclined to accept any kind of medical malpractice around concussion in particular. Crucially, I think down the line, Joanne, probably at some point we're going to face a high profile legal case, undoubtedly. Okay. It's happened in other countries. There have been some cases here related to permanent damage that have been related to schools, rugby, but I think potentially if there is a groundbreaking legal case, that's probably going to put an additional onus on most sports around the country to have greater awareness of how they're actually intervening and regulating this injury as well.
Yeah, because I'm even thinking back there to like the NFL, you know, and that concussion documentary, or the movie, I suppose, came out with Will Smith. Yeah. That was kind of when the NFL, I suppose, kind of stood up and said, oh, look, this is something we have to change. But something that I actually do remember from the NFL, going back to the medics thing, was I remember it came out like privately, probably at a meeting, where the medic said that, you know, if a game is on and say the likes of Tom Brady gets a concussion, they're under pressure to get Tom Brady back into the game. Therefore, that's why they decided to put an independent medical, like the little blue tent that we see on the sideline. That's why they decided to do that. Do you think that's something we should look at maybe in other sports? You know, should we be looking at the independent medics, or do you think that pressure is just across the board in general, you know?
I think, and in the ideal world, because of the nature of this particular injury, which, as I said at the very beginning, is very different to other injuries, of course, we would always have an independent medic available. But that's in an ideal world. Let's face it, you can't have that at home in Loughle tomorrow or in rural West Cork somewhere. What you tend to have, of course, are local volunteers who might have some level of health training. And they're simply there because they're maybe supporting their daughter, son, niece, nephew, whatever it might be. Of course, greater medical input and advice is always necessary, but it can't be the silver bullet, because we all, as I said, have a responsibility to say stop when it's required. Joanne, now, I don't say that lightly, believe me. I don't say it as a former high-performance player who myself has experienced concussion. I don't say it lightly as a family member. I don't say it lightly as a researcher who knows and is dealing with very personal and upsetting accounts from players who are today dealing with the debilitating effects of numerous concussions. And there's one interview that springs to mind in particular, a former county GAA player whose relationships are suffering because he's constantly irritable.
Yeah.
He now experiences what he calls minor fits on a daily basis. He's been unable to hold down his job. And he showed me in confidence, obviously, the neurological report, and it's ongoing at the moment because he's going through a number of consultations, and he's genuinely worried. And his neurologist is also concerned about the extent to which he said he probably has had, with the benefit of hindsight, at least 15 concussions that were untreated, and that he did precisely what you've just described there, which is to say, I'm going to play on, my team needs me. If the medics say I'm going to come off, then I'll come off, but they'll have to pull me off the pitch before I come off.
Yeah.
And some of those county medics were also relatives of his. So they felt under pressure both to look after him as a family member and as a player, but also because this particular county team had been and were vying to get back onto the top of the pedestal again when it came to provincial football. So all of us have a role to play in this, because the search for the kind of, you know, this ultimate sporting hero, it's deeply ingrained in us all, you know, whether we're participants or whether we're spectators. And it's in the habitat and in the habits of sport. But we have to understand that when that goes to its worst excess, we rationalize the need to play hurt. We accept risk as normal. We avoid a diagnosis of concussion and we over-evaluate success. So I suppose I always try to remind everybody that we have to ask how we constitute the sporting world and what we want from it, even if that makes us feel a bit uncomfortable. And that's, I suppose, one of the things that sociology and criminology, the things you've described, that's what helps in that process, because it allows us just to kind of stop, think and reflect.
Yeah.
What does it mean if we expect our players just to stand back up again? Why do we think it's the case that somebody's just game playing because they're lying on the ground holding their head?
Yeah.
And it might be the case, of course, that we know it. Game playing does happen. But increasingly, sports are managing that better. And I think we have to place our faith in the sports governing bodies and the officials who are being more cautious, who are shifting towards this culture of precaution and saying, I'm not happy at the moment. And the Welsh referee, if you remember, I think quite recently was very, what would I say? He probably had the highest example of good practice when he pushed back against players and medics and said, no, I'm not happy. I want this player tested.
Yeah.
You know, we have to recognize that level of practice as being an exemplary one, even if we regard it as being perhaps over-exaggerated, because this is the kind of injury where, quite frankly, if we do accept the risks that we do with many other injuries, it can lead to life-threatening injuries. So anybody, I think, that's promoting self-withdrawal should be supported in that. Anybody who tries to lay open a little bit more for discussion, like yourself, the narrative that places undue emphasis on being tough and hard, that should be rewarded as well. Because I make no apologies for being more cautious and taking this injury serious. I make none whatsoever.
Yeah.
Because these cases that are starting to emerge around the world will start to come to play in Ireland. There is one rugby player, former Irish rugby player, Killian Willis. I don't know if you know him, Joanne.
Yeah, I've read some of his stuff, yeah.
Yeah, his case is now underway across the water in England. He's taken a case against Saracens because he's arguing that he was put back onto the field of play, even though he was exhibiting some of the symptoms around concussion at the time. So I do reward anybody here who's willing to stand up. And if it is going against the grain, well, then so be it, because we are the custodians of sport for the younger generations going forward. And I take that role seriously, because I can see the ways in which I benefited from all those women, for instance, who many years ago fought against resistance to ensure that ladies' Gaelic football got off the ground in 1974, that women's soccer a year previously, that rugby many years after that, the early 90s, let's face it, I've benefited from them, their groundbreaking work. And I'd like to think that the research that's underway here at Ulster will also hopefully benefit future generations, because this is an injury that genuinely worries me above many others. And I don't want to see any more of those heartbreaking cases like the death of Ben Robinson and others in other countries as well.
Yeah, I remember even saying it to like the football team that I train. And I remember we were in a circle and we were all kind of like not laughing. We were kind of being dead serious in time. And I remember them saying to them, you know, you can survive without limbs. I was like, I think I'm the epitome of someone who can survive without limbs, but you cannot survive without your brain. Like, your brain is the be all and the end all, I suppose, at the end of the day. Like, it's everything, you know. Like, my grandmother is in a home and there's some people there, you know, with dementia and Alzheimer's, and like, I've seen like the worst of the worst, yet, you know, people think then because I have no limbs that I'm like the worst of the worst, you know what I mean? I think it's something that maybe we're not fully aware of, like how the brain works and different things like that, you know what I mean?
You make a very important point, Joanne. It's a very salient message and a powerful one as well, coming from you in particular. I mean, I'm the same. had a very dear family member who had a horrific brain injury last year. It wasn't sports related, I must say, but nonetheless, it opened my eyes to some of the, even the dimensions of neurological injury that I wouldn't have been aware of. And I would regard myself as being fairly up to date because of, you know, my own research interests. But lest it's an overly negative or downbeat message either, Joanne, I do come back to the point that all of us can impact on our own immediate sphere. Yeah. I mean, none of us are going to change the whole world in one go, but we can change our own immediate sporting spheres one step at a time or one wheel at a time, whatever that might be. Because the power does lie with us. I mean, if you're in your role as a football coach, my role as an educator, I still try to do a bit of coaching when I have time. We can set the tone regarding this norm of playing hurt, because I think if we keep our emotions in check and we remain balanced about the so-called importance of success, then we can create a set of shared values around the meaning of success, which means that sporting success isn't the be-all and end-all, because all of us have to be able to function many, many years into the future, given the aging population, given the extent to which, even with medical intervention, we're all living longer and hopefully living longer, healthier lives. And sporting involvement will be one dimension of that, but it is only one dimension. And I say that even for myself, being a former high performance athlete, for those at the highest level, of course, it's the immediate focus for a short period in time. But we have to be able to function and to make contributions to our lives afterwards. And if the organ that is the highest order organ in our body is fundamentally damaged precisely because of that love, then, as I say, I don't make any apology for wanting to be a little bit more cautious, to not ignoring or denying the issues. So even making a commitment, any listener today, even making a commitment to think about this injury further, represents a not insignificant step. Some will be in positions to do more than others because they'll have a greater sphere of influence. But even just taking this a little bit more seriously after today will make a difference, because up to now, all of the research that's been conducted in this area tells us that we tend to deny, to conceal, to overemphasize the importance of playing on at the risk of our health.
Yeah, I think you make such a strong point there. And I think if anyone is not kind of semi call to action, I suppose, after that, even as my joke about surviving without limbs but not a brain, you know, I think we're definitely, you know, kind of going somewhere. I just kind of wanted to ask you about, like, you know, you personally and kind of your future. Are you still going to continue to work on concussion, or are you going to divide between your three, with the identity, sport and identity, sport and gender and concussion, or are you going to settle down eventually?
No, never. I'll tell you what, the one thing I know is that the more I learn, the more I know what I don't know.
Yeah.
And concussion is one of the things that is going to pique my interest for a long time, personally and professionally. That's for sure. And it will do so also because I do have a passion for sport, and I want to be able to use the research findings for some kind of positive and policy impact. So I have two major projects that are ongoing, Joanne. I'm hoping, all being well, I'll, along with a colleague of mine in the UK, Joe Maguire, we're writing a very large book on sport and national identity at the moment, believe it or not. So I'm hoping that will be published by the end of next year. And in the meantime, we've got some research ongoing on concussion, around the attitudes to concussion in particular, particularly the attitudes of players who have apparently gone through NGB concussion awareness and education.
Okay.
And some of the barriers that they're still facing in terms of not implementing, I suppose, more of a precautionary approach to the injury. I also have some PhD researchers who are working with me on that. And if there's anybody out there who is willing to fund some more social and cultural research into concussion, well, then certainly get in touch, because there's an ongoing need, I think, to do this, because more of us are getting involved in sport for all the right reasons. But we just need to make sure that we have a balanced approach to that as well, and that we keep an eye on the health of the nation at the same time.
Yeah, it looks pretty exciting for you, and I wish you all the best with everything you do, and I hope that all your social and cultural changes will come, maybe not tomorrow, but maybe in a generation along the line. Hopefully, you know, we can see some changes coming in between stigma, masculinity and everything else between, and also women in sports. So thanks very much, Katie, for being on the show, and yeah, it's been a pleasure, and wish you all the best with everything.
My pleasure, Joanne. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks very much.
Thanks very much to Dr. Katie Liston for her conversation on concussion and the impact that it has on sport and societal impact it has today. Next week, we interview Martin McNally, GAA Monaghan referee, where he talks about refereeing in the GAA today and his battle with his illness and how it's impacted his life today. Tune in and enjoy.
The Big Red Bench.
Game on.
Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m.